Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Glad to have all of you with us for our show today. I do want to make an announcement at the very top of the show. This is one of those unusual days where we're recording the show a little ahead of our airtime. It's a little bit after 11 o'clock as we sit in the studio to record the show. I'm telling you that because you will be able to watch the show on Facebook Live at 2 o'clock. You may already be doing that, but we are not going to be able to respond to the comments that you post. And the same goes for Twitter, although we love for you to tweet us at PoliticsGPB. Have the conversation among yourselves today. That makes more sense. So let's get right at it because, oh, man, there's a lot to talk about. Greg Bluestein, it's Wednesday, and Greg, the political reporter, the lead political reporter, as I like to say, for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, is here with us. Hi, Greg.
How's it going?
Good. Glad to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Andra Gillespie, she's political science professor at Emory University, and we're always glad to have you back at the microphone, Andra.
Happy to be here. Thanks.
Ed Lindsay, former state representative, Republican state representative from Buckhead, is here at the microphone. Hi, Ed.
Always glad to be here.
And Teresa Tomlinson, the mayor of Columbus, Georgia, Democratic mayor of Columbus, Georgia, is with us. Teresa, last time we saw you, we were in Columbus at the River Center, one of the most exciting shows we've done. And the people of Columbus were so generous and lovely to be with. And we owe you a lot because you you paved the way for all of that.
Well, thank you for coming down. We had a great crowd, so that just means you'll have to come back.
We will absolutely figure out a way to do that as we move forward. As we will, we've got a number of cities on our plans in the months ahead, and we'll talk about where we're going to be once we've firmed all of those up. All right, let's get right to it. Obviously, the story about the separation of children from parents at the border has continued to drive the news cycle all this week. Let me summarize a few things and then open the floor for conversation. Number one, the president, of course, went to the Hill last night to meet with congressional leaders to talk about an immigration bill that Speaker Paul Ryan now tells us is going to be voted on tomorrow, Thursday. There are two bills, a conservative bill, a more moderate bill. The moderate bill does have a provision for ending the separation of families. The president, we are told in reports, some reports say he kind of favored the moderate bill. Other reports suggest that he kind of left everybody up in the air about what he would support. But that did happen yesterday. And the Democrats have already, Greg Bluestein, said that they don't want to have any part of this because they believe that the president can act on his own to end this policy. And so Chuck Schumer has said there are so many, to quote, there are so many obstacles to legislation, and when the president can do it with his own pen, it makes no sense. Legislation is not the way to go here when it's so easy for the president to sign it. But, Greg, let me be clear. The immigration bill, so that two bills, are about the broader issue of DACA, what to do about DACA recipients. The separation issue is just one little part of that.
Yeah, and Republicans are working on and Congress are working on a more narrowly tailored bill that would deal with the separation issue. Senate has one plan. The House has another plan. But President Trump, and they can't agree on which one to win back. And President Trump has remained defiant, basically saying that he is insisting on a congressional solution rather than signing an executive order or changing the policy from the White House.
All right. I'll open the floor. Do we expect that there's going to be a bill passed at all?
I think there will be. I think there needs to be. And I think that's the more important thing to look at. I like what Senator Ben Sasse put out earlier this week, in which he quite accurately stated that the policy of separating children from their parents is wicked. But he also made a point of going, the policy that we had before, which was basically catch and release, wasn't working and was foolish. And he said that, you know, in the American society, we should not have to be choosing between foolish and wicked. That if we start to actually get our hands dirty and fix the long-term problem, which we can in this narrow, still in the narrow area, but fix this issue of what to do with asylum seekers when they come to the border, we should be able to do so. And so I like folks like Ben Sasse, for that matter, folks like Johnny Isaacson, who's come forward and said that we need this kind of solution.
All right, but without regard to whether the bill will in fact deal with separation issue, I'm interested, Andra Teresa, in hearing Ed say he thinks one of these bills will pass. It strikes me that that's going to be a very high hurdle for the House to get over.
I think it's going to be a high hurdle. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the stuff that I've heard on the news suggests that they're putting these things on the floor without having really whipped them, so they really don't know how many votes they have going into it, and that just strikes me as a setup for embarrassment.
Well, it's been a tough week for nationalism and racism. I think what we've learned is that nationalism and racism is very hard in implementation. It seems to be fun for some people when you can put it on a bumper sticker or talk about collecting brown people and putting them in the back of your truck. And I'm careful when I say that, because how do you know those are illegal aliens or illegal immigrants except by the color of their skin when you're putting them in the truck? So we've seen a lot of reckless language related to these types of issues that are really gripping our country. And now we see an implementation, the horror of them, that they're inhuman, that this is why you have to talk about individuals who are trying to enter this country as animals, as infestation, as monsters. And I think maybe we've seen there might be some other monsters lurking around. So it's been a very disturbing week. I will say I did speak with a friend of mine who's in the national media, and I asked if there was even one instance of a non-minority individual seeking asylum that had been separated from their child, and the response was they've actually been looking and can find none.
All right, let me give you AP has just moved a story, Greg. I'm not sure. I know you've got your phone up. And again, we're recording the show. It's now 11:14, basically, on Wednesday morning. AP has moved a story which says this: Homeland Security Secretary, obviously that's Christian Nielsen, is drafting an order to end family separation at the border, unclear if Trump will sign it. That's a really important breaking story because we've asked on this show, as others have this week, whether this separation issue, which Trump seems to feel plays to his base, has been a bridge too far for even those Republicans who are playing to the base.
And again, he's insisted that this is the blame for Democrats. This is weak, and he's used the word weak and fragile Democrats who haven't changed this, who haven't been able to come to a congressional solution to this. He's blamed them throughout, even though it is his policy. It's been conservative outlets, liberal outlets, whoever. This is a Trump policy, and up until now, he has refused to change that policy. So we'll see if whether or not he'll sign this order.
Yeah, this did actually come out on Fox News before we went on the air. At least it was hinted at. One of the news hawks out there that in Georgia land that watched these things pretty closely gave me the heads up, but we couldn't confirm it. So it looks like there is something that's percolating. And I just wanted to speak, Bill, to a couple things that you said. I'm so glad to hear that they're going to end this policy. It's going to be very costly to rectify it, I might add, and for the American taxpayers, for those fiscal conservatives out there, you need to understand that some of these policies are quite costly. But I do think that some of this is built on false premise, and we need to understand. I heard some wonderful numbers this morning on Morning Joe. They were talking about that we have the lowest levels of immigration in this country right now, last year and this year, and the 3 or 4 years before that, and we've had since 1971. In 1999, there was 1.6 million immigrants, and this year and the years previous, looks like 300,000, 400,000. So we are doing some things right. I know Ed talked about the foolish and the wicked, but there has been some good policies.
Well, keep in mind, what I'm talking about is a very, very narrow issue, which is what to do about folks who come to the border and seek asylum. And that generally is folks who are coming from the South, who are coming seeking asylum, many of which have legitimate claims for asylum, and they should be brought into the country. Some also do not and should be sent home. And so that's what we're dealing with here. It's not the larger immigration issue, but a narrow issue dealing with what to do with families who come to the who come to the United States, come to the border, walk straight up to an ICE agent and say, you know, I'm here seeking asylum. They're not trying to break our laws. They are trying to come into the country through legal means and are seeking a legal way in. And the question is how to deal with those particular individuals. And so and the problem has been in recent years, and that's what Senator Sasse was referring to, is what to do with these folks, because some folks were trying to manipulate the system to come into the country illegally up through the catch and release process. And so what we've got to do here is to take care of this issue narrowly, keep the families together while the proper asylum process is taking place to see who has a legitimate reason for coming into the country. Senator Sasse has a solution. Senator Cruz has a solution. Other senators have a solution. I am a little disappointed to hear that Senator Chuck Schumer in New York wants to simply just sort of set it aside, because whether you agree with who started it, and I do agree, this is a change in policy by President Trump. Regardless of who started this issue, we need a long-term solution.
Yeah, let me, Andra, that I pick up on that. I think it's important.
This is really tough, and this is sort of the sort of crassness of the policy in the first place, that this, you know, in many ways was a political play. And so part of the reason why Democrats don't want to play ball with this is that, one, I think they want to give the president and the wider public a civics lesson about what tools are at the executive branch's disposal. Because for the last week, President Trump has acted all passive. All I do is enforce laws, right? As though there is no interpretation of the laws, as though the presidency hasn't expanded its power by interpreting loopholes and things. And so by putting the blame on the legislative branch for their inactivity on the broader issue, he's now sort of, you know, if they fold or they cave on this one particular issue, then that, from just a PR standpoint, absolves the presidency of any responsibility for this. And I think somebody has to hold him accountable for, one, the messed up civics lessons he tries to teach the American people and his lack of responsibility on this issue.
You see, I believe this is a civics lesson as well. It's a civics lesson showing that Congress needs to step up and act. Far too often, both through Republican administrations and Democratic administrations, we have Congress who sit on the sideline, and instead of taking the necessary legislative steps that they should be taking, sit and whine and scream about what is right and what is wrong. And it's a bipartisan abdication by Congress.
Right.
And this is a chance for Congress to actually step up and actually do its job.
Can I say amen to Ed?
Is that right? Greg, I want to bring this closer to home for the next little while. This has put Republicans, mm-hmm. especially Republican incumbents, in somewhat awkward some of the incumbents in somewhat awkward positions. I think it's safe to say, especially our congressional delegation, mm-hmm. but we've also heard response from the two Republicans running for governor. So let's start with the congressional delegation. You and Tamar Hallerman filed a story in which you laid out how people were reacting. And one of the things you said is that most members of the Georgia delegation don't want to talk about this at all.
Yeah, they kept this at arm's length early in the week. But then there was sort of a change yesterday as the pressure continued to mount. And most of them started coming out, rather than not talking about it, said that there needs to be some sort of legislative solution. They now have, at least in the House, a House plan to back. But especially for Rob Woodall and Karen Handel and the two more competitive districts in Georgia, they know that this could quickly become a midterm issue, and Democrats have ratcheted up the pressure. We heard from DuBose Porter, the chairman of the Democratic Party. We've heard from the Democratic candidates for those offices, and of course we heard from Stacey Abrams, the Democratic nominee for governor, saying that this is a nonpartisan issue. It's a moral one.
So just to quote her, you and Tamar in your piece quote Karen Handel. She says, "We must find a more humane, compassionate approach, one that keeps families together to the fullest extent possible as U.S. immigration authorities determine appropriate steps. At the same time, we must secure our borders to stop the flow of illegal crossings." That's pretty much the tone that everybody's taking, or certainly on the Republican side.
Oh, my God, I would hope so. I would say, you know, where were some of these Republicans when Obama had a policy which allowed individuals to apply for asylum from home, so they didn't rush the border, so they didn't spend 3 weeks on a concrete bridge with their infants, so that they didn't have their infant that they were breastfeeding ripped from their arms. And it was actually the cancellation of that policy by the Trump administration that has caused this our borders to be besieged. So I think, yes, now that we've seen the horror of this, I would hope that any elected official would be making such statements. But my question would be to all those out there is, where were you before this?
So, Andra, this does put a Karen Handel in a tricky posture. She did not win that seat by a large vote. We know that there are Democrats who are eager to try to get her out of office, and the district is changing, turning more and more purple. How do you deal with it if you're Karen Handel? You try to, you know, straddle the fence?
Yeah, you try to thread the needle. And you try to use a both and sort of, you know, a tactic as Ed has suggested. The question that we don't know yet is how people are going to react to it. So we know nationally, there's been a national, survey that's come out. And so we see Democrats are overwhelmingly opposed to this family separation issue. We see Republicans, our independents are net opposed to this issue, but Republicans are net supportive of it. It's by a little less than a 2-to-1 margin. And so it becomes a question of, for the 6th district and for the 7th district, where do Republican voters in this district fall? Are they in that slightly more than a third? Who are, you know, opposed to this policy, or do they represent the 58-ish percent who are, who support this issue? And in particular, I would be looking at women, because these are districts with suburban, educated white women who might think that this is a bridge too far. And, you know, unfortunately, just based on the numbers that they put out, I can't tell sort of like, you know, who's in that, you know, roughly third of the Republican cohort who doesn't support this.
Let me caution this group. About, you know, because when I hear talk about, well, Democrats believe, then I hear, well, Republicans are worried about tactics. That's somewhat demeaning and partisan.
Just but I didn't say that.
Hold on. But I've heard it through some of the other people in this group today. I know Karen Handel, and Karen Handel's been in office for less than a year. She wasn't in office when President Obama was in office. And there were a lot of things that President Obama did wrong when it comes to the immigration policy, too, which he could have fixed in 2009 when he had a Democratic Congress. But beyond that, Republicans like Karen Handel, and I know Karen Handel, and I know Johnny Isaacson, too, who both come out pretty strongly against this present policy. Let's not simply say, well, Democrats oppose, and Republicans are trying to straddle a certain tactic here. Because I'm prepared to accept both of them at their word in terms of they oppose the present policy.
But Greg, it does seem, let's take what Ed said very seriously and hear it. But at the same time, Democrats have a lot less to lose right now over this than Republicans do from a political point of view. It strikes me. One of the things I'm interested in is, it just occurred to me that we do, of course, have a Democratic runoff in the 6th District between mm-hmm. Lucy McBath and Kevin Abel. It strikes me, and please tell me if you think I'm going in the wrong direction here, Abel has positioned himself for this issue to really be one that he can hit a home run on. He's been talking about the president of immigration. He himself came into this country.
South Africa.
So he, in an interesting way, could be a big beneficiary.
And in his rhetoric, he's bypassing his Democratic opponent, Lucy McBath, and pivoting right to Karen Handel, saying, why isn't Karen Handel the more vigorous opponent of this? Why isn't she speaking up for the immigrants who live in the 6th District? And by the way, on the Republican note, I got it. We have both Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle and Brian Kemp in different, using different scopes of rhetoric, but they're both defending this policy as well and saying essentially that Congress should have a more comprehensive overhaul. I talked to a Republican operative this morning who's been polling on this issue, who said for them it's a no-brainer to keep on standing with Trump in this. Not only is Trump, continuing to be beloved by Republican voters and the very same voters who will vote in July 24th runoff, but also the immigration issue, especially when you put the word Trump before it, is just sky high in their
polls. Well, and that's why I want to agree and yet so strongly disagree disagree with Ed's observation is that I do think we talk too much about politics. And I think that what the Democrats need to do is state what they are for related to this and let the Republicans die on the vine of the weight of this. But this is not new, and this is not political nuance. For about 30 years, the Republicans have opened Pandora's box related to nationalism and racism. It's been an underbelly, not to paint with a broad brush. We all have friends that we know that are incredible people that don't want any part of this. But they've ridden the wave of the benefit, and now there's a price. There's a price when people see these policies that were used to drive them to the polls to vote in anger and hate, and now they see the implementation of it, and there's a price.
Well, I'm so glad to hear that the mayor says that some of her best friends are Republicans.
All right, let me stop. I do need to get a break in here. I want to come back. I want to continue the conversation about how this issue affects us here in Georgia, certainly the political races that are underway right now and will be through November. But let's take a break. We'll come back in just a minute. You're listening to Political Rewind. Welcome back to Political Rewind. Columbus Mayor Teresa Tomlinson, Republican insider Ed Lindsay, Dr. Andra Gillespie of Emory University, and Greg Bluestein in the Political Rewind studio today. Again, we're recording the show a couple hours before airtime for a variety of reasons. If you're already watching us on Facebook Live, that's because we did record it for Facebook Live, but we're not going to be able to respond to your observations and comments, but keep the conversation going. All right, Greg, let's go back and look again at how Georgians are responding. Senator Isaacson, quote, "It's tragic. We've looked the other way too much, and we've got a lot of people out there who now fall into this trap. It's not going to get better. It's going to get worse." John Lewis, of course, very outspokenly critical, saying these children are being used for a political reason to satisfy a political commitment that Trump made to his supporters, and meaning the wall. He believes they're using the kids to get the $25 billion in one of the immigration bills that's being will be debated tomorrow. Nathan Deal, "It's always traumatic when you have to confront these situations. This one has brought more tension because we've apparently seen such a huge increase of numbers of families with children at the border." And then David Perdue. Mm-hmm. David Perdue has stood absolutely solidly behind President Trump, and he is doing it in this case, too. I think it's safe to say he's blaming it on the Democrats.
He is. He's blaming Democrats for what in his view, incentivizing illegal border crossings and stonewalling GOP immigration bills earlier this year. He says the media is obsessed with the latest, in his words, bright, shiny object. And his quote is, "I wonder if they really want to solve this or they want it for a political platform pandering opportunity for the elections this November." Remember, Senator Perdue is one of Trump's most loyal allies, and this is the sort of language he's used before whenever there's a controversy over the Trump's vulgar comments over the Haitian immigrants comes to mind. He said something very similar, like, "Get over it. This is a one-day thing. Move on."
Andra Gillespie, there have been accusations, obviously, from the opposition that President Trump has been tone-deaf in dealing with the heart that's involved in this issue. And even in the language, Ed Lindsay used the phrase "catch and release," but Democrats have been using that without thinking too. Just that phrase alone, in addition to infestation, that sort of thing. David Perdue talking about it the way he has. I mean, it does feel as if there are an awful lot of politicians who are incredibly tone deaf about the emotion behind this.
Yes. And it could be that they are single-mindedly focused on whatever political end goal it is that they have, which makes the problem worse, right? Because it looks like you're using children as a bargaining chip in a really, really, really inappropriate way. President Trump's language, where he's doubling down on his language, and he's doubling down on it in part because it's been effective before. So he's using, you know, that ramped up, ginned up language about immigrants, because look, that's how he started his campaign, and it's what got him notoriety, and it's what got him a lot of support. And so, you know, the question that I have for President Trump is not that I don't see a strategy in what he's doing, but it's a question of what your short-term strategy, your medium-term strategy, and what your long-term strategy is. And so now that these things have been said, yeah, it might get you some stuff in the near term, but long-term, you know, this is going to have an impact on your legacy. And this is also going to have an impact on the Republican Party's efforts to reach out to a new America that, despite all of their kicking and screaming, is not changing.
All right, so Ed, let's bring it back to Georgia again. I'd like to stay with me on Georgia for a minute. So you've got Casey Cagle and Brian Kemp engaged in a fierce runoff battle right now, both taking a strong Trump line on this. It strikes me Kemp, who has kind of made his name in this campaign by being as blunt as he can. Yes, I did just say that, all that sort of thing. His statement's a little bit more adamant. I think I stand with Trump 100%. Cagle's, you know, trying to be supportive, but also opening the door for, you know, we've got to figure out a solution. This shouldn't be happening. All right. So I get that in a runoff, they're both taking this position. What the heck happens when they one of them wins and faces the general electorate in November? We don't have any sense yet of how Georgians might feel about this and how it could linger all the way through the fall.
Well, that is an open question, because in the end of the day, one of these two Republicans and or perhaps Stacey Abrams will be faced with the difficult task of governing. And, you know, it's often easy to run to your base in a primary, or sometimes even run to your base in a general election. But in the end of the game, you've got to actually sit down and govern. You've got to look upon these children, whether they be black, white, brown, or whatever, as God's children, and take care of them. Yeah. And as folks that need to be cared for. What I've been trying to emphasize here, and I'll emphasize every place else as well, is that I want to push both parties. I want the people in both parties to simply say, look, we're going to do the difficult job of governing. We're not going to simply stand in front of a microphone and either promote or denounce, but we're actually going to have to get behind a room and write the bill that will be both just and compassionate. That usually requires a little bit of messiness and imperfection, but it's the right way to govern. And these two guys who are running for the nomination, Republican Party, are going to have to show the people of Georgia how they can govern. And quite frankly, so will Stacey Abrams.
So, Teresa, perhaps it's dilemmas like a Republican candidate for governor in this state or any other state may be facing, congressional incumbents, whatever, that may be is weighing in to some extent on what we've just learned, that the Department of Homeland Security is looking at issuing an order that will keep these families together. There's got to be a way out of this.
Well, you know, as I said earlier, it sickens me to talk about the politics of this because the substance of it is so important and people don't talk about the substance. But to talk about the politics, this is very good for Kemp. He's already way out there. These are going to be really ardent, super conservative voters coming on July 22nd. It's going to be, I'm afraid, not good for Cagle. If Cagle makes it out, I think he'll fare better, of course. But it's certainly his to lose, as we've said many, many times. Keeping it Georgia, as you said before, Greg mentioned some things that Senator Perdue had said. And he also said that we had to stop the perverse incentive that was causing people to storm our borders and seek asylum here. And I would just point out that perverse incentive is the shining city on the hill, as Ronald Reagan said. They're coming here to save their sons from the MS-13 that our folks are talking so much about, because they recruit at 9 and these kids are 6, 7. They're trying to save their kids. And so it's not perverse and it's not to round them up in trucks. It's important. But yeah, it has a political impact.
Can I add one thing to what Teresa said? And I agree with her. And this is something that no one is talking about. And this is one thing that frustrates me, is that no one is actually talking about working with these governments in Honduras, in Mexico, in other countries in Central America, and going, okay, you've got a problem. You got a problem that's impacting us. I'm sure that you would rather keep your good people who are fleeing your country to stay in your country rather than flee to our country, many of whom we would love to have because they're good people. But isn't it better to try to figure out ways to work with these other countries to go, look, you know, what can we do to help you stabilize your country and make your people feel safe and make your people feel like they've got a future right where they are?
All right. Let me just say, Ed's right. He's right. It's a great humanitarian effort. We could take the better side of it and go to Honduras and help through a humanitarian effort.
All right. Greg, a couple other quick notes, because we got a lot more we need to cover today. First of all, as you said, Democrats are calling on Governor Deal, saying, do not send our National Guard to the border as part of a Trump mandate, essentially, that state National Guard's got to be down there. We've now got about eight governors of Republican states in many cases.
Like Massachusetts.
Yeah. But Governor Deal's never suggested he was going to send troops.
He hasn't. Way back in the early spring, when Trump initially made this call for some reinforcements from National Guard to protect the border, Deal indicated that he was not going to send any Georgia National Guard troops. He repeated that yesterday when I asked him. He said they have not been formally asked. It might be some wiggle way out of it. But he said he's still not intending to send any Georgia National Guard troops. But at the same time, we have had several Republican governors and Democratic governors saying that not only are they going to withhold troops, they're going to call back troops, they're going to withhold any resources until Trump ends this policy. And now you have Democrats jumping on that as well, saying that Deal should put that in writing, that he should say that there will be no Georgia National Guard troops into the border until this policy is reversed.
All right, look, this is not going away. We are going to be talking about this for a long time to come, clearly. And we know that tomorrow the U.S. House will take up, or we're told by the Speaker's office, they will take up the two immigration bills. We'll see where the president stands. We'll see where the Georgia delegation comes down on the conservative or the moderate bill. Do we have any sense of that, Greg?
I think that they're going to split by chamber. I think the Senate will vote for the Senate bill, the House will vote for the House bill, and then there'll be some messy conference committee stuff that will be unfolded over the next few days.
All right. And we'll see whether the president wants to sign the Homeland Security order. I would think they're not issuing an order unless the president was on board. Christian Nielsen does not strike me as someone who acts independent of the president, Andra.
Well, I mean, she may be trying to be preemptive and just have something there. So, you know, I don't, just because I didn't hear about this until I got in here, I'm a little skeptical of it. And so, I want to wait until I see what happens.
Sure.
Also keeping in mind that she got run out of a Mexican restaurant yesterday in D.C. Like, maybe she just wanted this so that she could have it, so that she could say, hey, I tried.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm sorry I'm cynical about this, but yeah, I mean, and to add, like, yeah, I agree with you. Previous administrations, when dealing with drugs, people talked about the domestic situations in some of these other countries. But, you know, I know President Trump, you know, has managed to, you know, paper things over with Kim Jong-un. But when you have continually maligned groups of people, I don't think they actually really want to play ball. And he may learn the hard way that that incendiary rhetoric that works when you're dealing with that type of dictator in North Korea does not work, you know, when you're in Central and Latin America.
All right. Well,
actually, that's exactly my point that I've been trying to make. Incendiary language, pointing fingers at each other, accusing the other side of evil intent, doesn't get you anywhere. At the end of the day, I learned this in the legislature. At the end of the day, if you want to bring somebody over to work with you, you've got to tone it down a few notches.
We're going to change subjects, but I do think it's important to point out that we have some of our more conservative panelists who, if they were here in this studio today, would absolutely say, Greg, the president and Jeff Sessions and Homeland Security are doing exactly what is necessary to stop the huge wave, what they call a huge wave of immigrants trying to get into this country.
That the zero tolerance policy is the only policy to deter illegal immigration. Yeah, that's exactly. And we've heard from Georgia politicians in Congress and here in Atlanta say the exact same thing.
All right. Let's move on if we can. As I said, we'll come back to this. I know it's a meaty subject, but there are other things popping up. Greg, I believe you covered this unveiling of the plan. Mm-hmm. The first $100 million. Is it the first hundred big expenditure of money for a transportation project since the legislation was passed?
Yeah, we've only had two huge cash infusions from the state to mass transit projects. And a few years ago, we had $75 million, but that was scattered throughout the state. Athens got buses. Valdosta got some mass transit spending. Columbus did. Atlanta did. This is $100 million now to one project. And that's bus rapid transit. It's going to go to building at least 4, probably closer to 6, bus rapid transit stations along Georgia 400. It's the first time the state has directly partnered with MARTA and Fulton County on a project like this. And it's something that is something of a sea change. I think Ed can speak to this for Republicans in Georgia who, and Democrats too, back when Democrats ran the state, who you once vigorously opposed spending state funds on mass transit capital projects like this, and now are embracing it.
Well, I think this is an enormous step forward, and you are seeing a sea change by political leaders in this state. And what's really going to be interesting is not just this project, which I think is vitally important to that 400 corridor, if you've ever tried to either drive up it or drive down it in the morning and the afternoon, but it's going to be interesting to see what impact this has with other areas, Gwinnett County, Cobb County, who are more and more going to see big ticket business development going to where the transit stations are, and whether it be bus or a train, and bypassing these other places that want those similar projects. And so I think it's a great step forward. And, you know, it's good to see Governor Deals coming on board and working toward it. It's good to see local mayors in the suburban areas like Rusty Paul advocating for it. And former Mayor Jerry Wood was also an advocate for it, and all the way up the line of 400. And it's going to be, and it's interesting to now see, you know, the leaders in Gwinnett County recognizing that. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens with Cobb County.
Teresa, yes. I think that Ed makes a great point. If you're in Cobb County, where voters have been much more reluctant to support transit in any form, you might find yourself left way behind at some point in the not too distant future.
Way behind. You're absolutely right about that. I'll say I was so excited when I got Greg's tweet yesterday about this particular article. And, you know, the last several years under Nathan Deal's leadership, and I give credit where credit's due, we have really taken some significant steps to transform transportation. We still have a long way to go, but it used to be you could not have a conversation, particularly with the Republican leadership, about anything having to do with mass transit, light rail, things of that nature. They likened it to Amtrak, highly subsidized, you know, Northeastern liberal stuff. And so now to see this evolution, I think, is very exciting, and it's something that our city needs. But I do want to say, interestingly, I literally got Greg's tweet, and as I was opening it and reading the article, I got a flash from the New York Times. It said, Koch brothers, Koch brothers start national effort to squash mass transit.
They are all, I mean, I don't know that we know. I saw the New York Times piece too, and it's fascinating. The Koch brothers are mounting campaigns in states around the country to fight transit. But before, let's talk about that. But Andrew Gillespie, we know you as an Emory University professor are sitting here saying, okay, good for 400. When am I getting my Clifton Corridor transit?
Well, I mean, so, you know, in terms of state legislation, I don't know. I mean, but, you know, it's definitely, you know, in the works. And I've been stuck on 400 myself. So this is a no-brainer to me. And so, you know, I saw the headline for the Koch brothers. The Koch brothers don't live here. So the Koch brothers have never taken 2 hours to get home when you're trying to get from Alpharetta to Atlanta. So, you know.
But they didn't live in Nashville either.
Greg, the Koch brothers.
But here's the deal. And first off, it's really great. I think it's at Clifton Corridor is at the top of the MARTA Atlanta project list. Is that the Koch brothers represent a generation other than my children? Okay, you know, and that goes beyond party. I mean, my children's generation, the X generation, and whatever what comes after X,
Millennials,
Z, whatever,
well,
millennials,
X,
whatever,
millennials, Z,
millennials, and then come the X, millennials, and Z. I think my children are maybe in the Z category, but the point is that generation wants it. That generation wants to live, doesn't want to sit in a car for 2 hours.
It makes a great point, Greg. This is generational. To some extent, it's whether you grew up in the South without any kind of public transit or whether you grew up in the North with subways and elevateds and all that sort of thing. But the Koch brothers fought and won an effort in Nashville to pass a sales tax that everybody thought was going to go through, and it failed because the Koch brothers came in with their machinery. And their point is, this is a wasted investment because people are not getting out of their cars, which is exactly to Ed's point that older people feel that way.
Well, I asked that question of Sandy Springs Mayor Rusty Paul, a frequent guest of the show, who is firmly on the mass transit bandwagon, I guess. And I said, what accounts for the sea change? She goes, reality. It's reality. It's look at, I mean, we mentioned Gwinnett County before. NCR had its headquarters in Gwinnett County for, I don't know, 5-6 years, just moved to Midtown to be closer. State Farm, Mercedes-Benz, Porsche is down at the airport. They're moving to where you have mass transit, and Republican and Democratic leaders who represent those districts see it happening.
All right, I got to get another break in. And when we come back, we've got still got more than I can possibly get in the time we have remaining, but we'll get to some of it. This is Political Rewind. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Political Rewind. Greg Bluestein, let's talk as quickly as we can. I got two things I want to get in. One, we know that the Supreme Court of the United States the other day kicked the can down the road on partisan gerrymandering cases involving Maryland and Wisconsin. In Maryland, it was Republicans suing Democrats. In Wisconsin, it was the other way around. But they basically said, we're not taking these up. And the votes were unanimous on this. But Georgia still has a couple cases, and North Carolina has a big one that apparently the court will hear next year. Have I got this right?
You do, and all this means is we'll be watching Monday mornings for Supreme Court rulings very, very closely, not just the rest of this term, but the next few, because there's still a chance for a very momentous decision from the Supreme Court about these redistricting bills that will affect Georgia legislative districts.
Andre, this is really in one of your sweet spots. How did you react when you heard the court kick the can, as I've said, down the road?
So I contacted a friend who's a voting rights lawyer just to sort of see what his opinion was about this. And so he wasn't surprised by it. One of the interesting things that he pointed out, so I'm just going to parrot what he says, is that it seems to be that the Supreme Court is moving towards a very, very highly specialized, individualized definition of who is actually sort of a victim in these cases. And so that's actually going to determine who is going to be able to bring these types of cases. And so because people were making these broader types of pronouncements about state injury and not necessarily saying that they individually were harmed by these districts, that might actually make it harder for future cases to come forward. The other thing, just in talking with him and just knowing sort of what people have been talking about kind of in the academy and in industry, is that probably part of the reluctance to actually do something on this is that people cannot agree on what is the proper definition to determine whether or not harm is being done. So people are trying to look at things like when you see a statewide congressional vote be really lopsided, like 60-40, but then the Democrats and then, you know, Republicans end up with a majority of the seats or vice versa. That should be evidence that there's something funny going on in the books in terms of gerrymandering. But the problem is that people have not actually come up with a good definition that judges can understand and actually agree upon. And so it's just the job of academics and not just political scientists, not just law professors, but actually also mathematicians to be able to come in and create a formula that everybody will agree on to be able to determine whether or not there's funny business going on.
What you're seeing a lot of times is political parties on both sides get too cute for their own good. And end up pushing an issue that in the past, you know, folks would go, no, we're not going to go there. I remember in 2001 here in Georgia, the Democrats passed a redistricting bill that did a great job staying just within the historic permissible range of 5% up or down. Well, the problem was that every Republican district was 5% up and every Democratic district was 5% down. And the courts came in and said, okay, you've gotten a little bit too cute here. We gave you a little bit of latitude, but we're not going to allow you to get that cute. And then it became a one-person, one-vote issue. And you're now seeing that also happening on a partisan basis when it comes to some of these districts that are being drawn around the country, in which the courts are going to have to be forced to start taking a look at it. My advice to politicians is don't get too damn cute. Stay between the lines.
Right. But Teresa, what this means is that voters in many states, and Georgia is certainly one of them, and this happened with Democrats, as Ed pointed out, back when Roy Barnes was governor, now with Republicans. So it's not one party or the other. It's both. don't really have the opportunity to make a choice about the political philosophy and the partisan identity that goes with that philosophy. They're kind of forced down a chute to go one direction right. or the other.
And that's what you see the Supreme Court wrestling with here. They had an opinion in 94, 2004, now these two opinions where they've dodged the ball. And I really think, Bill, something big is coming here. And I'll tell you why. I think that, as Andra said, they don't want to get into this because it's a political question, right? I mean, we vote and we vote our folks in, and if they want to laden us with some sort of lopsided system, well, that's who we voted for, right? But then, of course, you catch yourself in the catch 22 is that, well, we can't not vote for them now because they've made it impossible for us to vote the bums out.
But
I think they're coming. I think the reason why usually they start discarding these cases on standing and procedural matters, not running to the meat of it when they really don't know yet what they're going to do, but they want to do something big and they want to do it right.
But Andra, Is it a fair question when we hear it said that the Supreme Court really would rather not get involved in how political parties are operating within state? Is that yes or no a fair question to be resolved?
I mean, is it a fair question? Perhaps, but then it becomes a question about who should resolve this. Like, I mean, you know, you could resolve this by saying nonpartisan districting, right? But that's a legislative question, and that's actually probably a referendum type of question, depending on where you are in the country. But also because the standard is so vague, because people cannot agree on sort of like what the standard of fairness is, like that makes, you know, that sort of lends credence to Teresa's point. We don't know what to do yet, so therefore we're going to decide on the margins about other things and then save this potentially for another day.
You wait to the worst sort of case.
Yes.
And that's when they're ready to act. And let me use a case as an analogy. For years, the courts wanted to stay out of recusal issues when it came to judges and campaign contributions. They were going to stay out of it. They stayed out of it until there was a situation in West Virginia in which someone running for the Supreme Court received several $1 million worth of contributions from an individual who had a case before the Supreme Court. And that helped get that person elected, and that person then refused to recuse himself.
Right.
That's when the Supreme Court was finally willing to act. And so what we're looking for is that really horrible case in which the Supreme Court feels they have no choice.
They want to have clear constitutional impact.
Okay, well, so let's see if that's in fact what they're doing, waiting for the case that gives them that opportunity. North Carolina could be it. Emmett Bondurant, right here in Atlanta, one of the star lawyers in this town, is involved in that case. All right, so Greg, we hear the cliche all the time. With the Trump campaign and administration, all roads lead back to Russia. You know, whether it's true or not, we hear it all the time. There are some ways in which, when it comes to gridlock and the inability of people to work together to solve problems in Washington, all roads lead back to gerrymandering. And until we solve it, we're never going to get very far.
And statewide, too. I mean, look, we have, 236 state legislative districts in Georgia. Maybe one or two Senate seats are truly competitive ideologically. Maybe a dozen or so House seats are truly, you know, down the middle because they're so drawn to favor one party
or
another.
Well, let's watch that. I'm kind of moving us along because I don't want to miss a chance today, Greg, to say that this is a big anniversary for the state of Georgia. It was 25 years ago today that what happened.
The first lottery ticket was sold, and the governor is going to have a big ceremony at the Capitol this afternoon celebrating that landmark achievement.
In 1993, this date, the first lottery ticket sold. Hope has been credited with helping nearly 2 million Georgia students get to school. I think it's $1 billion in lottery money. Let's just listen to Zell Miller, who is the father of the Lottery and the Hope Scholarship, when he gave his State of the State address in 1993 and introduced his programs, including Hope.
Right now, only 15% of our kids are graduating from college. It is only 8% south of Macon. Georgia can do better. Georgia must do better. Other than health care, which largely must be addressed at the national level by Congress, this is the single best way With the lottery proceeds, Georgia can provide scholarships by the thousands. This is Georgia's opportunity to pioneer the most far-reaching scholarship program in the nation.
I got to say, the first thing I have to say is, it just does my heart good to hear that steely mountain accent of Zell Miller. But, Andre, we know that there are flaws. We know that too many kids whose parents can afford to send them to college are getting to take advantage of it. We know that it isn't broad enough. And yet, it has been transformational.
Yeah, I mean, and I think we all give credit to the late Governor Miller for his vision. I mean, you know, it's funny 25 years later thinking about this and thinking about some of the debates that I've witnessed as a child across the country since I didn't grow up here, you know, in the late 80s and 90s, you know, this was fraught, you know, because it's gambling, right? And so there are these moral issues that come up with, you know, supporting gambling. And now we wouldn't even think twice about it.
Yeah.
Well, And let me sort of pick up on something that you mentioned in terms of families that could afford to pay. Those families oftentimes chose to have their children go out of state. And those children then, when they went out of state, stayed out of state. Instead, those families are having the children stay. And my family was one of them. I have two sons, and I want a shout out to both of them. They kept the Hope Scholarship all 4 years. But my point is that not only did it benefit a lot of kids who economically could not afford to go to college, to go to college, and that's extremely important. As Stacey Evans has so articulately set out in the past. But it's also kept other families who perhaps could afford to send their children elsewhere, and we were having a brain drain with those families and those kids then choosing to go live somewhere.
Teresa, you're nodding vigorously.
That's absolutely. I mean, you know, Pennsylvania does something like this. Pittsburgh in particular has the Pittsburgh Promise, and they started that some time ago when they were struggling so that they would keep those kids who they wanted to keep to prevent the brain drain. But this has been a transformational, you know, policy, and it's just been amazing to see it grow. And you know, I wonder what the new statistics are. I you know, had not, if I heard that, it's been so long, certainly I forgot. Zell Miller said only, 8% or 6% of those below Macon have a college education?
I think he said something like eight.
I would love to know what that is today, now that we've had the Hope Scholarship.
Great.
Good question. As a Hope Scholar myself, I credit Zell Miller and the lottery program for keeping me in the city.
All right. Well, Greg Bluestein, we know you're heading to that ceremony at the Capitol, so we will look for your reporting at Political Insider on myajc.com and, I assume, in tomorrow's newspaper. We're out of time after this really terrific conversation. Teresa Tomlinson, we love having you up here. Ed Lindsay, Dr. Andre Gillespie, and Greg Bluestein, thank you so much for really good show today. We'll be back, of course, on Friday at 2 o'clock, but tomorrow at 2 o'clock, we're doing a two-way street about the life and music of the great, great Savannah-born composer Johnny Mercer. And if you don't think you know his name or his music, just listen to the show, because Johnny Mercer wrote just about every exciting popular song in the second half of the 20th century. So I hope you'll stay tuned for that. I'm Bill Nigut. See you all for Two-Way Street and Friday Political Rewind.